From donations to appropriations, an influx of money is set to help change services in South Dakota forever. We continue now with In the Moment. Coming up this hour, we talk with Bill Gasson, CEO of Sanford Health, about a $300 million donation and how the health care organization plans to revolutionize rural health care, starting with education for future doctors and specialists. We look at the potential of a Senate bill that seeks to infuse South Dakota airports with funds to help them rebound from the pandemic into a more robust future. That's coming later in the hour. Plus, the grief and loss of COVID-19 has changed the way we mourn and celebrate life. A new Frontline looks at Black funeral homes in New Orleans and the lives of America's last responders. I'm Lori Walsh. You're in the moment.
I'm John Wynn with SDPB News. 120 people are out of work in Hill City, where a sawmill is closing down. SDPB's Seth Tupper reports.
Nyman Enterprises says it's closing the facility after 53 years of operation. In a news release, the company blames the U.S. Forest Service for logging restrictions in the Black Hills. Company president Jim Nyman was not immediately available for an interview. In the news release, he says, "I never thought I would see the day when we would be out of options to keep all our facilities running." The Forest Service did not respond to a request for comment. Nyman Enterprises is part of an industry group called the Black Hills Forest Resource Association. Ben Wootke is the association's executive director.
This has a tremendous impact on our capacity to manage and care for the forest. And of course, a tremendous impact on our communities as well, who rely on jobs and employment through the forest products industry for the economic well-being of the communities in the Black Hills.
In addition to the Hill City operation, Nyman Enterprises has another sawmill in Spearfish and additional facilities in Wyoming, Colorado, and Oregon. The U.S. Forest Service is assessing the sustainability of logging in the Black Hills National Forest. A draft research report recommends a drop in timber harvest to maintain trees suitable for logging. Bob Burns is a member of a conservation group called the Norbeck Society. He says the group has asked the Forest Service to reduce logging for several years. Burns says the damage to the forest may already be done.
We've warned that if the timber volumes get too low, we'll be losing lumber mills. And apparently that's what's happened.
The Forest Service's final report on sustainable logging levels is expected soon. For South Dakota Public Broadcasting, I'm Seth Tupper in Rapid City.
COVID-19 cases are up for South Dakota K-12 students in the past week. Schools report 251 students and staff tested positive for the coronavirus since last Sunday. That's up 10 cases from the previous report. 178 schools report at least one current infection. Schools have recorded more than 14,000 total cases since last fall. Colleges and universities report 36 COVID cases last week. Students and staff have recorded more than 500 cases since January. Authorities say a shipping delay in steel has pushed back the timeline for construction of the new Watertown Regional Airport Terminal. Airport manager Todd Syrie says the delay will require an extra month or so for construction, likely moving completion to early next year. Construction on the 25,000-square-foot terminal began in November. Syrie says other aspects of the project, including completion of the foundation and elevator shaft, are on schedule. The new building is expected to cost between $17 million to $20 million. New information from the State Climate Office shows nearly 80% of South Dakota is in some form of drought. Laura Edwards is the state climatologist. She says recent rain and snowfall across the region have improved the situation.
We might see some ups and downs, some small improvements in the drought situation in the spring season, but as we get deeper into the summer, into the growing season, it looks like we could be getting worse again. By the middle of the year.
Edwards says long-term forecasts predict warmer-than-average temperatures are likely going into April and May. For SDPB News, I'm John Wynn.
Getting back to the office could be tricky as employers consider vaccine policies for their workers.
Right now, our research shows that more employers are actually encouraging it rather than requiring it.
I'm Molly Wood. Will the workplace ever get back to normal? Next time on Marketplace.
Tonight at 6:30 Central, 5:30 Mountain on SDPB Radio.
Program funding is provided by the South Dakota Cultural Heritage Center in Pierre. The museum now offers free admission to South Dakota residents and children from everywhere. Coronavirus protections in place. More at 773-3458 or history.sd.gov.
Thanks to your support, South Dakota Public Broadcasting is able to bring you live coverage of high school sports and fine arts events. We take pride in shining the spotlight on achievements of students in the classroom and on the stage. Support SDPB now and help us continue to offer high school sports championships and all-state music presentations. Donate at sdpb.org/donate.
State House coverage provided by Boyce Law Firm, building lasting relationships that transcend generations, representing a variety of industries and employment matters, including defense of workers' comp claims, experience, integrity, community. BoyceLaw.com.
Health reporting on SDPB is supported by Monument Health.
You're listening to In the Moment. I'm Lori Walsh. Well, how is a $300 million donation to Sanford Health set to transform medicine in rural areas? It begins by educating the physicians and specialists of the future. And we're joined today by Sanford Health CEO Bill Gassen. Welcome to In the Moment. Thanks for being here.
Yeah, thank you. It's a pleasure to be with you this morning.
Before we talk about this new $300 million donation from T. Denny Sanford, I want to look back at some of the other major gifts and how Sanford has been able to use that money to really change things, because I think it will help us understand what the future might look like. What can you say about some of, you know, that 2007 $400 million donation or the $125 million gift that helped start Sanford Imagenetics? When you look back at some of that philanthropy in the past, how has it really changed healthcare in this region and really around the world?
Yeah, you know, I'd start, I think the best way to describe Mr. Sanford's philanthropy and what it's meant to Sanford Health, what it's meant to the region, is transformative. And if I go all the way back to his initial gift to us that helped establish the Children's Castle here in Sioux Falls on our Sanford campus, that was transformative. And what that has done and what that has meant to the provision of pediatric services, specialty and subspecialty care in this part of the country has been incredible. It's had an amazing impact on the families in this part of the country that have otherwise, but for his giving, would have had to travel outside of this part of the country in order to get that type of care. And he's allowed us to be able to provide a higher level of care to people where they need it, when they need it, close to home. And if I go forward to his transformative gift subsequent to that, the $400 million, it did the same thing. It's changed our organization and, more importantly, healthcare in this region forever. That's allowed us to stand up some incredible initiatives, some of which we've talked about of late, and we think about the Edith Sanford Breast Initiative there and what that's done, allowing us to have, I think now 25, 26 different units allow us to provide 3D mammography around our care continuum. And in fact, I think we've provided over the last year nearly 90,000 mammographies, 96% of which were all 3D mammography. This is allowing us to change lives, transform lives here and abroad, thinking about the international clinics and our ability to stand up primary care clinics in Ghana to be able to transform. We've got over 30 primary care clinics there across the country of Ghana. And then flash forward to today, the announcement that we were able to make last Friday. Yet again, Mr. Sanford continues to, I think, astonish people with his generosity. And the $300 million there, I think, as you stated in the opening, is going to have a significant impact, not only for Sanford Health, but for medical students for care in this part of the country. Today, we're very blessed at Sanford to be able to fund and to run alongside with our partners at the Universities of South Dakota and North Dakota Medical Schools, seven medical residency and fellowship programs. We're going to now add to that an additional eight, upwards to close to 200 medical residencies or residents and fellows that will be training at any given time across the system once those eight programs have stood up. And I think the important message that I want everyone to be able to understand is that because of that gift, because of those efforts, we're now going to be able to ensure for the people who trust us today with their care that not only now, but for generations to come, the high level of care that they've come to know and trust is going to continue. Because we're going to have those skilled physicians who are trained in this part of the country, who understand our people, that understand our culture, and believe in the same things that we do, are going to be able to provide care for them into the future.
I want to talk a little bit about how some of those, again, early gifts, without realizing this is what you were preparing for, the people who came before you were preparing for, as they had vision for what they wanted to create, how did it come to fruition during the pandemic with the kind of healthcare infrastructure that South Dakota had in place for treating COVID, which nobody really saw coming, although there were pandemic plans in place, and really the vaccination effort? Because as South Dakota has been as successful as we've been in vaccine distribution and administration, Sanford has been a critical part of that. Can you make a link between the infrastructure that these kinds of donations and gifts and planning helped create to how we weathered the pandemic and a global health crisis?
I'd be remiss in starting off there if I didn't pause just to say we've got a lot of amazing partners who we owe a big thank you to. Here in the state mm-hmm. of South Dakota, the partnership that we were able to forge with the Department of Health really meant a lot. The partnership that we were able to forge as we battled through this pandemic together with our partners at Avera, our partners at Monument. Everybody makes healthcare better in this state by competing, and we continue to do that. But in important times, like fighting through the pandemic, just grateful for the wonderful providers that we have across this part of the region. As it relates to Sanford Health specifically, and I think about the giving that Mr. Sanford provided to us earlier, and then how that really manifested itself today, we think one of the things that allowed us to be most successful was the fact that we're an integrated system. It's that systemness, the coming together of all those component parts is what allowed us to be successful in the fight against the pandemic. It's research that we were able to stand up with Mr. Sanford's gift. It's the addition of the Good Samaritan Society and our ability to partner with long-term care and acute care to be able to move patients quickly into the right level of care at the right time. We believe that that was an important component of allowing us to be successful. Through the vast infrastructure that we have in our supply chain, that's allowed us to distribute these vaccines over a massive geography of more than 200,000 square miles to be able to get to and from any one of those locations in a single day because of the infrastructure that we put in place that was enabled in many respects because of Mr. Sanford's giving. The patient registry that we have been able to establish through our research department has allowed us, again, to be able to know and understand our patients, be able to reach them in a more expedited way. And then importantly, our ability to be able to stand up trials and allow us to be able to use those. And today at Sanford, we're grateful that across the areas that we provide care continue to be some of the leading areas for vaccine penetration. We're not done yet, as you know, in this fight, but we do believe that we're winning. We're starting to win the war. Hospitalizations, thankfully, are down. We've got the vaccination rates are up, and our positivity rates for testing are continuing to fall as well, too. And so all critical indicators that demonstrate to us that the work that we're doing, the work that's underway, is being effective in the battle against this virus.
We're talking now with Sanford Health CEO Bill Gasson. In the moment, you're listening to SDPB Radio. And Bill, I want to ask about the future, because this first phase, this $300 million donation addressing rural health care and graduate medical education, those fellowships, those residencies, also the Sanford Sports Complex and softball, baseball, and soccer fields. But you're already looking ahead to later on this year in this notion of a virtual hospital. Tell me a little bit about what we learned about keeping hospital capacity down through virtual health care. And what is the future of this virtual hospital? How does it fit into what we already kind of know about the pandemic? And what have we not imagined yet?
Absolutely. One of the positives, if you will. We always look to try and derive positives out of really challenging situations, especially in healthcare. And over this last year and the crisis that we've been through with the pandemic, one of the positive takeaways or results has been the uptick in the adoption for virtual care. And that's on the patient side, that's on the payer side, as well as on the provider side. And now those services, that technology has been out there, but sometimes you need an event or a series of events to drive that or to serve as a catalyst for that adoption. And we really did see that necessity is really what drove it, because there was no other way to be able to reach safely the patients and get to them when we could. And that's really helped highlight the need for increased investment and expansion within virtual care. And so part of the rationale for us in moving forward with virtual care, it's been on the roadmap for us for several years, but especially coming out of this last year, we've really seen the incredible impact that it can have. And so virtual care, the virtual hospital, what that means for us, what that's going to mean for the patients who we serve today and those who will serve tomorrow, is no matter where you're living, this is going to ensure that you're going to be able to get the highest level of care where you need it, when you need it. We pride ourselves in being one of the premier rural health care providers in the country. That's important to us. The people who we care about, the people who've invested in us, the people who believed in us, largely live in rural communities across our footprint. And we want to make sure that they know that they can be secure, that Sanford Health cares for them today and we will care for them tomorrow. This is going to allow us to meet the challenges of making sure that you've got enough providers and that you've got the right level of care in these smaller communities. And through the virtual hospital, that's going to allow us the ability to bring specialists and subspecialists alongside those primary care physicians, those internal medicine physicians who will be in those communities providing care, providing them with the necessary backup, allowing someone to get the right level of care to be able to quickly determine, can we meet those needs there, or are we going to need to transfer them to a larger facility, with the goal always being, let's keep them home. Let's keep these people close to home as much as we can, providing them with that care. Through the virtual hospital, we know that we're going to be able to do that as well in our long-term care, our skilled nursing facilities also. They allow us, at the push of a button, to be able to bring that high level of specialty and subspecialty care to those residents who need it and who are otherwise, perhaps because of the situation that they're in, not best suited for travel, not best suited for being pulled out of those facilities where they're comfortable, where they're known, and then move to a larger hospital. And at the end of the day, it's going to allow us, again, to do a better job of meeting the needs of our patients and residents, our people, and our communities.
Will that relationship in turn potentially help redefine elder care in the sense that, you know, most people prefer to receive their care before going to a long-term care facility? What will the partnership with Good Sam, how will the partnership with Good Sam intersect with this concept of a virtual hospital in the future?
It certainly will. One of the emerging areas right now is that care at home. And through the virtual hospital, again, that's going to allow us to connect with our patients and our residents, whether they're in a facility, a hospital, whether they're in a clinic, whether they're in a long-term care facility, or whether they're at home, to your point. If we can help these people avoid having to leave their home and go into a skilled nursing facility or otherwise, we want to be able to do that. We want to be able to, again, do what's right for those patients, right for their families, as soon as possible. And we do believe that this will provide us with a critical advantage to be able to accomplish that.
We've been talking about this donation from T. Denny Sanford, and you know his electronic device was the center of a child pornography investigation with the U.S. Department of Justice, as was reported by ProPublica. Now, that started in 2019, I believe, and to this point here we are in 2021. No charges have been filed against T. Denny Sanford. Have you been assured that there was no wrongdoing in this case as you continue your partnership with Mr. Sanford?
We're very confident in the partnership with Mr. Sanford. We took those media reports seriously and are satisfied that they were not substantiated.
Were you assured by him or someone else that there was no wrongdoing?
We are assured.
I want to wrap up with this next part of this donation. Are we expecting an announcement by the end of the year for a virtual hospital for what happens going forward?
You know, we're very fortunate that even as we were announcing it on Friday, we were actively working with Mr. Sanford on the details around that. Whether it's the end of this year or the start of 2022, that'll sort of be determined based upon how quickly we're able to stand up and iron out all of the details and the milestones for that. But I would look to some announcements in that time frame.
We look forward to having you back on the program. Sanford Health CEO Bill Gassen, thanks for being here today. We appreciate your time.
Thank you for your time. I appreciate it.
Up next, we look at a new frontline that talks about grief and celebration of life in the time of COVID. We head to New Orleans after the break on listener-supported SDPB Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, the director and co-director of the film Soul, which is nominated for an Oscar for Best Animated Film. We talk with Pete Docter and Kemp Powers, who also co-wrote the film. Powers also has an Oscar nomination for his screenplay One Night in Miami, which he adapted from his play of the same name. Join us.
Tonight at 7 Central, 6 Mountain on SDPB Radio.
Program funding provided by the South Dakota Humanities Council, presenting Voting Why It Matters, featuring virtual events with authors, activists, and scholars, including Gloria Steinem, Louise Erdrich, and Thomas E. Patterson. More at sdhumanities.org.
I'm Jackie Hendry, host of South Dakota Focus. State lawmakers considered more than 500 pieces of legislation this year. We reviewed the key issues with legislative leaders ahead of veto day. Plus, Peer-to-Peer with Lee Strubinger features journalists who covered the session firsthand. And Seth Tupper explains why South Dakota lawmakers hear each and every bill that's filed in the 40-day session. That's Thursday night at 8 Central, 7 Mountain on SDPB-TV.
Program funding is provided by Denny Menholt Auto Group, Rapid City. During this time, we are here and ready to serve you, still providing the same quality service you've come to expect. Doing our part to keep you safe at Denny Menholt Auto Group, Rapid City.
Listening to In the Moment, I'm Lori Walsh. Death is Our Business, the new documentary from Frontline, takes viewers into two of the oldest Black-owned funeral homes in New Orleans to spotlight the devastating impact of coronavirus on the Black community in the city and its cherished cultural practices. The film presents an intimate look into Black Americans' traditions of remembrance, and it sheds light on how the outbreak has disrupted beloved funeral rituals for a city that is all too familiar with loss and grief. This new Frontline premieres tonight at 9 Central, 8 Mountain on SDPB-TV, also on pbs.org/frontline, on YouTube, and in the PBS video app. Jacqueline Olive wrote, directed, and produced Death is Our Business, and she joins us today on the phone. Welcome. Thank you for being here.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
There was a little music coming in. I almost didn't want to start talking over it because it was from Ellis Marsalis, who was also featured in Death is Our Business as he died during the pandemic. Tell me a little bit before we get to that part of this really touching and moving documentary, how you came to look into these funeral homes, which have been around, you know, some of them since the 1800s, and have built such strong traditions in the city.
Sure, they've been long-lasting cornerstones in Black communities, funeral homes around the country. I was very much interested in looking at the ways that Black people uniquely funeralize their loved ones after having relatives of mine pass away during the pandemic and not being able to attend the funeral and to say goodbye in the way that I would normally like. I was just really interested in that when I started to research the project. And then I started to think about New Orleans, which has had such has been so hugely impacted. Black folks in particular have been so hugely impacted by the coronavirus pandemic in terms of the infection rate and the death rate. Blacks are about 60% of the population, and yet they are 72%. They account for 72% of the deaths in Orleans Parish. And so understanding how difficult and challenging this has all been for everyone, particularly Black people, the opportunity to look at the ways in which the burial and the acknowledgement of folks, relatives, family members, and friends, how it's had to shift in a city in which those rituals and practices are so steeped in generational and African tradition. Looking at how those have had to shift was really the opportunity to explore issues around the racial disparities as well.
And we talk about those disparities. There is also this legacy of Hurricane Katrina and how it impacted Black communities, how it impacted New Orleans, how it impacted loss and grief. Tell me how those two are maybe forever kind of linked in the history of this city.
They are forever linked. And everyone that I talked to, I hadn't really thought about connecting Katrina just because I was looking at the pandemic in particular. And as soon as I got to New Orleans and got on the ground, people were making those connections, almost everyone immediately. And it's because Katrina was so devastating and the impact for Black people was particularly devastating because of these issues that around housing and economic issues and healthcare issues came up during Katrina. And it was so actually traumatic. And New Orleans is really just starting to move out of that. It was a decade, as Louis Charbonnet says in the film, it was a decade before they even started to move beyond the devastation and started to process what happened at Katrina. And so people are making those connections with this pandemic, which has brought up those same issues. And it's kind of irritated a wound that was already there.
Yeah. Let's talk about Charbonnet and this this funeral home that he has. And just because this is such a human documentary where you see real people's stories of living and dying during this time and serving the people as you have your own losses mount up. He talks about how, you know, turning people away and telling them, you know, there's a limit on this because we can't let you all in, and what that does to people to not be able to grieve and celebrate life in a way that they're used to. Tell me more about what you learned from him.
I learned so much from him because I hadn't really thought from a funeral home or funeral director's perspective. Mm-hmm. And so I learned that the pandemic has really hit them very hard in particular. It's that people are turned away. At one point, there were, as it has been across the country, there were only 10 people allowed. Ellis Marsalis' funeral that you mentioned earlier, he's a culture bearer in New Orleans, and there would have been 15,000 or more people at his funeral and the second line out to celebrate his life and to help his soul transition over. And so when you have top, the maximum capacity of 10 people, that means that close family often are not able to say goodbye in the same way that they would to their loved ones. And so it has been a huge shift. And that's what some of the things that Louis Charbonnet at Charbonnet Funeral Home and Jasmine Navarre, who's also in the film, at Rhodes Funeral Home, some of the things that they've been dealing with, in addition to the fact that they have taken on, they've had to take on so many more funeral services. I just spoke with Jasmine a couple of days ago, and they are still at about 14 services a week, which is it's far beyond what they were doing before the pandemic still. And so there are funeral homes who have had to shut down because they couldn't handle the demand. And there were funeral homes who shut down early on in the pandemic because they were concerned about the risk to their health and the staff's safety.
I'm going to go back to what you said and help people understand more about these traditions of the second line and the jazz band, or you know, the jazz funeral, the horse and carriage, the thousands of people lining the street in this second line. Say more about that tradition, and really, this is more than just a, you know, it's not for show. There's a richness to that tradition that has meaning. Tell us more about the depth of that.
Well, and the second lines, particularly the second line that we filmed, involves Mardi Gras Indian. And so they're Indians, and they're in their costumes and their pageantry, and it's beautiful. So it could easily look like it's for show and for entertainment, and people can come off the street and participate, including tourists. And so it can feel like entertainment, but what second lines really are, and Delphio Marcellus, who's in the film, says it best. He's Ellis Marcellus' son. He says it best, is that this is an opportunity for the community to come together, to hold up, to support the family, to lift them up, and to come together, and everyone collectively are able to process their grief in community. And so when we were filming, it was one of the things that I wanted to make sure that we did, is to show that event through the eyes of the people who are participating, who in all likelihood had a second line for a family member of theirs who knew, who understood that level of support. And so all of these people who are coming out in the street, many of these people understand that the second line is this celebration, but it's not, like you said, it's not a show. It has a really very meaningful purpose. And so I worked really hard to show that. And so it doesn't look like what it could from the outside, yeah, but to show it from the inside.
It made me think too, you know, like you, I've lost people during this pandemic. I've been pretty open on this program about my brother's death last year. He lived in Minnesota, and we had a funeral. There were, you know, and he had been sick, you know, with cancer for several years. So we had had time, the gift of time, to really plan. Thank you. To plan what we wanted it to be. And then, of course, you know, with the same thing, like we knew who he was and who was going to come and how this was going to have meaning. And at the end, it was 25 people standing 6 feet apart and not even hugging. And as I watched your documentary, it also made me think that this grieving process isn't done for us, we're not finished with it, and we need to go back and revisit what happens next. And that gets to this idea that someone in your documentary says, we might have to come back here a year from now. What happens next? What are you hearing from people in New Orleans about the unfinished work and whether or not there will be a way to do that in the days ahead?
Sure. Yeah, I've also lost family members during the pandemic. And it started out actually early on with my godmother, Frances Jordan, and she was beloved. And there would have been, I think, hundreds of people there to celebrate her life. And it's particularly important for people of color whose lives are not, the value of their lives are not adequately acknowledged often as they're living, for people to come together and really honor and acknowledge and memorialize them properly. It's such a loss to not be able to do that. And so I think that where things are moving is, one is to do what I did and I'm hoping is really effective in the film, is to offer the opportunity for people as they're watching to be in a space together, or apart, but connected in however you can around this, around the idea that there needs to be a more adequate memorialization of the 500,000 people who lost mm-hmm. their lives to COVID, but also those people who died during that during this really difficult time, and to really use this film and use these moments and create more moments in which we can connect with each other, and really help to process the grief that the country, I know, is feeling, but we haven't taken enough time to really look at. And then the other thing is to really start to, again, remind people of these issues around inequity that are accounting for the reason why folks in New Orleans are so disproportionately, Black folks are so disproportionately impacted by the coronavirus, and to tackle those so that when the next pandemic comes along or the next crisis, which will come along, is that there isn't that same level of trauma.
Yeah, this is not, that disparity was not based on genetics.
No, absolutely not.
Yeah, and that you point that out in the, and then you, this is also about, and that I want to go back to what you said about people whose lives were inadequately acknowledged while living. This is about justice, not just about, you know, public health. What
it
do
is,
you
it's
think?
Absolutely about yeah. justice.
What do you think that we learned? I mean, I guess, well, I know what we learned. Do you think that policymakers are prepared to do something with the information that it was so stark about, you know, racial inequities? Our Native American community in South Dakota was far more impacted than the non-Native community, for example. We know right. that. We have that data almost in real time because of how closely we all followed, you know, the infection rates and the death count and things such as that. Has there been a shift that you think that people are ready to do something about how we structure our healthcare services to have more equity? Are you seeing that from the Biden administration? Are you seeing that from lawmakers? Where does that go next?
Well, I'll tell you that part of the, and we didn't always have those numbers, which is important to acknowledge. It took a yeah. very long time for the country on a federal level to start to get those numbers to understand the problem. That was very frustrating for me as I was looking at the coverage of this issue. And so with those numbers, then there's more information about those areas. And you're absolutely right. Black and Indigenous people have been so much more disproportionately impacted than the rest of the nation by these issues. And so that then brings up to the surface really glaringly the areas in which there needs to be work. And that is in healthcare. That is around issues of homelessness. That's also around issues of how inequity contributes to physical issues that can exacerbate a virus. And so looking at all of those things is extremely important, and I see it happening. I see it happening in pockets, but there's room to do more, and there's room for policymakers to do more and to step forward with solutions. But also there's room for us, you know, I feel like we're in some ways more connected than not because we've had to be still in our lives in the middle of the self-isolation. Mm-hmm. There are ways in which we understand more deeply our connections in communities, and that we use that information to push policymakers and to push politicians and to push these institutions that we are operating in to do the work that that they're really charged to do in service of everyone in the country.
One of the things that I found particularly insightful and even healing for me personally was just how, you know, open and honest and just, you know, the vulnerability on their faces. Some of these workers were embalmers and funeral home directors, and the people just, you know, adjusting a candle or a curtain to make sure that it was perfect. This is a documentary that really honors the work of what one woman calls, you know, we are the last responders, not the first responders. Let's just close with a little bit about when you talked with those people, and I'm so sorry about the loss of your godmother, Frances, and other people in your life.
Thank you.
That must have been really emotional for you to kind of meet some of those people who take that kind of care with the people that we love so much, that bring that honor to the process. Tell me personally, if you don't mind, did you find a little healing in making that for yourself as well?
Absolutely. The whole process, I approach filmmaking and tackling these issues that can be really challenging to face them and to move through them and get a deeper understanding, an intimate understanding with the people that I'm filming about where we are and how we can move forward. The entire process is healing for me. I think also what's really healing is seeing folks like Jasmine Navarre and Louis Charbonnet, folks who are running and staffing these Black-owned funeral homes, to see them present in the midst of what is extraordinary circumstances for all of us. Imagine all that we've had to deal with during the pandemic. And then if you add on top of that, the risk that they're taking and what it takes to be present. Stephanie, who is the embalmer that you mentioned, who really eloquently says that they are the last responders. Stephanie spent a total of, I think, at least 30 days straight without a day off, working at the height of the pandemic in March, April, and May. And so to see their commitment to doing this work, despite all the risk and all the challenges that we're all facing, and then more, I think is really inspiring for me, and I think it's really extraordinary.
Yeah. This is called Death is Our Business. It's a tradition that's far from my personal life, and yet a documentary that's incredibly close to my heart. So thank you for the heart and the personal nature that you brought to this, Jacqueline. And thank you for being here with us today, because I think this resonates with so many people. We appreciate your time.
It's great to hear, and it's been my pleasure. Thank you.
Death is Our Business premieres on Frontline tonight on SDPB-TV. It's online at pbs.org/frontline on YouTube and in the PBS video app. The film will broadcast nationwide on World Channel, and that's on Wednesday, March 24th. Death is Our Business is a collaboration between Frontline, Firelight Media, and World Channel. We were talking there to Jacqueline Oliver, who wrote, produced, and directed the film. We'll leave you with a little bit of music. This is called Crescent City Summer from Ellis Marsalis, who died at the age of 85 during the pandemic in New Orleans. You're on listener-supported SDPB Radio.
I'm Tanya Mosley. Like so many of us, Carrie Bartmans of North Carolina is reflecting on her relationships during a very difficult year.
You know, they always say during tough times you find out who your friends really are, and I think we did.
Here and Now listeners share how they're finding meaning in life during this pandemic. That's next time on Here and Now.
This afternoon, beginning at 1 Central, noon Mountain, on SDPB Radio.
Statehouse coverage by Boyce Law Firm, building lasting relationships that transcend generations. Whether planning for business succession or your legacy through estate planning, we have expertise you can rely on. Experience, integrity, community. BoyceLaw.com.
These days, the scene at home is busier. Hands full, meal in the oven, a dog begging for your attention. With so much going on inside, how can you stay connected to what is going on outside your home? Ask your smart speaker to play NPR. You'll get the latest news from your community and beyond. We'll keep you company while you keep things moving.
SDPB is here to cover what's important to you. Just give us a shout. Ask your smart speaker to play SDPB Radio. SDPB's extensive legislative coverage includes, in their own words, hear debates and conversations from South Dakota's legislators. In Their Own Words is supported by SDN Communications. More at sdncommunications.com. Business and Community Development reporting on SDPB is supported by SDN Communications. Learn more at sdncommunications.com.
You're listening to In the Moment. I'm Lori Walsh. A new bill awaiting Governor Kristi Noem's signature could give the South Dakota travel industry a boost. Senate Bill 162 would distribute funds to restore flights after several routes were cut last year due to the coronavirus pandemic. State Senator Greg Jameson sponsored the bill, and he's hopeful that the flights will not only be restored, but that new direct flights could be added. Dan Lettler is executive director of the Sioux Falls Regional Airport, and he joins us now. Dan, welcome. Thank you for being here.
Yeah, thank you, Lori.
We're past the one-year point of the first presumed positive cases and the first loss of life in South Dakota due to SARS-CoV-2 and COVID-19. Can you take us back a little bit, though, to help us understand the ripple effects of that at the Sioux Falls Regional Airport and some of the, like, how soon did that disruption really start to show up? What can you tell us about that?
Well, really kind of a tale of the start of the year. We started off January, February, really on a record pace. We had more people flying out of the airport than ever, really to the point where we were concerned about, you know, February and March especially, our peak usage for our parking, public parking. And we were well on the pace where we didn't believe we were going to have enough parking, and actually encouraging, I never thought I would actually encourage people to, you know, get a ride to the airport or, God forbid, use Uber or Lyft rather than trying to come out to find a parking place. And then, you know, news of the virus started coming out. But then really, you know, I think some of the, like the NBA, a couple of their players tested positive, and then they suspended their season, and then you had the NCAA tournament, canceled the tournament. So then all of a sudden, boom, these activities that people are used to and watching and sporting events all of a sudden were stopped, canceled, and that led to people deciding, you know what, it must not be safe to travel, so I'm going to cancel my trip even though I'm supposed to fly out next week. So really from, you know, mid-March to the end of the month, it was just, it fell right off the cliff, even to the point in April, we only had about 5% of travelers that we normally would. I mean, we had people, you know, for the day, we had 15 or 20 people traveling. So it was such a huge, huge drop-off. And typically, you know, it was so empty, it reminded us of, you know, blizzards when everything is shut down and there's nobody in the terminal building. And it was that way almost all month long in April.
But you had some extra parking spots, yeah.
What's that?
You had some extra parking spots at that time.
Yeah, we had actually plenty of parking.
So I want to jump ahead a little bit, in the interest of time. And I want to, as things slowly turn around and we kind of entered this, you know, what is normal phase, let's talk about this Senate bill and the funds that could go in. What would that do if, you know, Governor Kristi Noem presumably is going to sign this legislation? What happens next?
It really provides, well, not only the airport, but the community, a very important tool when we're going out to recruit an airline to consider new service to Sioux Falls or even resume service to a destination that we lost. You know, one important aspect of that is, you know, what type of risk abatement or, you know, revenue loss insurance do you have? So we often call it a revenue guarantee, but it's usually a fund that an airline can draw from for the first year to really make sure they at least break even. So any losses they might incur, they can draw from this fund and at least break even, which typically happens in the first year of new service. So, you know, and it has to come from the community. The FAA doesn't allow airports to fund that type of a program. So it either needs to come from the state or the local community. And it's not a small amount of money. You know, typically, they're looking at least for $1 million for 1 year to help support a new route. So if we're trying to go out and talk to an airline to start up service to New York or Houston or Washington, D.C., you know, we're competing with the Cedar Rapids, the Fargos, the Des Moines, even Omaha, for that one route, because airlines have shrunk. They're 15 to 20% smaller than they were a year ago, and so fewer planes, fewer flight crews, but the same number of airports in any given region that are really trying to get that service back into their community. And you can guarantee that every one of those other airports or cities has a package that they're willing to provide as an incentive for them to fly into their city. And so this is this tool would be very important for us to be competitive in trying to get a route back into our market.
What are we looking to resume that we have lost? What are some of the routes that are not there anymore that might be prioritized?
Well, it's two aspects of that. One is, destination. So Delta had a nonstop to Atlanta, and that was pulled, right away, I think, in April. And we didn't have it up until, now it's spring break and a lot of people are going to that part of the country. They did return it temporarily, but there's no guarantee it's going to be back, on a permanent basis. So and making sure that route is there is really important. But more so than a city, it's really the level of service. So like Delta and United in particular have reduced their flight schedule. So fewer flights, smaller planes. So the available seats out of Sioux Falls, are well over 30% less on those two airlines. So for trying to get them to upsize their aircraft, provide more seats to markets they already serve, that's certainly something we would consider. But we do want to also focus on, routes that we don't have. Again, I mentioned New York and Washington, D.C., our top 10 destinations out of Sioux Falls. Those are two destinations that we have, 50 people a day, year-round, going to those cities. In a normal year, and that we don't have nonstop service to that, if it were started up, I'm sure would be very successful. So those are things that, we would be speaking to airlines about, but now we can confidently go and say, if you consider this route, we have something to help support you to minimize the risk for you to try this route until we can prove that the local community will embrace it, will use it, and it can be supportive on its own.
So is South Dakota, is this legislation, and I remind us exactly how much it infuses into the industry. It's not a huge amount of money, in the grand scheme of things, especially with the influx of federal money and the way the state budget was this year. Mm-hmm. I'm just going to ask you, is it enough? Do you wish that there had been more? How do you feel that this legislation addresses the problem? How much can it help? And what mm-hmm. more would you need to really lay some of that infrastructure for the future?
Well, certainly not. This is a one-time request. Mm-hmm. we're not coming back every year for more dollars. And the one thing about this is, unless we're actually successful in establishing a new route, the money isn't used. And even then, mm-hmm. the airline has to report a loss for it to be used. So, unless we're actually successful, it doesn't get used. But we've never had a tool like this to this extent to be able to go out and really aggressively recruit new service. And there was an economic impact report provided by the state DOT published earlier this year. If we had one new route a day on a regional jet, 70-seat jet, that would bring in over $4 million in economic benefit just on one route, one daily route through the year. And we would intend to, if we had $1.9 million, we would split that and try to utilize, half of that for one route. So for $1 million, we can get well over $4 million in local economic benefit. So, and if we were to get two routes, obviously that's quite an investment mm-hmm. or a return on a $1.9 million investment. So we're pretty excited about the opportunity to go out there and aggressively recruit for new air service that will not only benefit the community, but provides more convenient service to another destination, provides a level of service As we try to retain our local travelers rather than have them drive to Omaha or Minneapolis to get on that nonstop to some of these destinations, you know, you'll be able to do that here. And so we think it's very important for us to continue to grow, and as our community grows, that we have more avenues for people to travel to and from Sioux Falls.
Well, Dan, I'll put in my personal plug for the Sioux Falls Airport, because I did one of those flights out of Minneapolis once and got stranded on the side of the road and missed a really important event on the way through Minnesota. So ever since then, I'm like, what's Sioux Falls got? Because I'm not doing that again.
At least check this out first, right?
I just want to ask you before we let you go, what, you know, for people now who haven't been flying, not because they couldn't, but because they just were not ready to, maybe now they've been vaccinated, but yet they're still thinking about COVID precautions. What's in place right now?
You know, of course, everybody that comes into the terminal building, you're required to wear a face mask. And that's through your entire journey. So from the moment you come through the door, through the checkpoint, to the gate, on the plane, obviously, and then on the other end when you pick up your bag until you leave, a mask is required throughout the entire journey. I mean, that's not really new, but it is actually federally required now. Mm-hmm. And so you may be going in a community or even in South Dakota where, you know, you just came from a restaurant, you didn't have to wear a mask. Well, you come through the doors here, until you get to your destination, you do have to wear a mask. But people need to know on the inside of the aircraft, those planes are probably cleaner than they've ever been with the amount of disinfecting and cleaning that takes place in between every flight. The additional work that every airport, including Sioux Falls, does to make all the surfaces clean. We disinfect constantly. We have... You know, the escalator rails have special lighting to disinfect those handrails. So, you know, every precaution that we can take, it's never been safer from a an infectious standpoint than it's ever been. Things you probably notice that things are busier than you would expect. We're still nowhere near what it was before, but there are more people traveling, especially this time of year with spring break and snowbirds and that type of thing. So it certainly is busier than maybe people would have expected. But, you know, those precautions are still in place to try to keep everyone as safe as possible.
Including all those flight attendants and pilots as well.
Right, exactly. Exactly.
Dan Lettler is Executive Director for the Sioux Falls Regional Airport. We've been talking about Senate Bill 162, which would distribute funds to restore some of those flights and services after the coronavirus pandemic. Thanks so much, Dan, for being here with us today. We'll appreciate your time and the update.
Great. Thank you for having me.
That legislation, by the way, is awaiting Governor Kristi Noem's signature. That is our show for today. We hope that it served you. Tomorrow on the program, the Dakota Political Junkies are going to talk about Governor Kristi Noem's appearance on the Tucker Carlson Show as we dig further into House Bill 1217. We'll also talk with an author about a book on climate change and what you can do to make a difference. Thank you for listening.